Welcome to Food for Thought, the place to explore, celebrate, and manifest a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. My name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau, and I'm your host. You can learn more about who I am and what I do by visiting my website, joyfulvegan.com. Today's topic is rights and wrongs when rituals mask cruelty. For millennia, humans have engaged in rituals with the intention of achieving a wide variety of desired outcomes, reducing anxiety, alleviating grief, deepening faith, or even making it rain. Though rites and rituals can be used for positive or innocuous effects, they can also disguise discomfort and make unjustifiable actions seem legitimate. They can be meaningless, arbitrary, and archaic. They can also mask cruelty to animals by being shrouded in religious sanctity. And that's what we're going to talk about today. But first, I'd like to welcome you all to the show and thank you for your response to the last episode about mainstreaming the 30-Day Vegan Challenge. The list of 10 things that I mentioned in that podcast episode that you could do to mainstream the 30-Day Vegan Challenge is now on joyfulvegan.com as a blog post. And I know a number of you have been using it as a checklist, just checking off each of the things, and it's just incredible. You have been responding so beautifully that at this writing, there are 60 five-star reviews of the book on Amazon. And you can see lots of blog reviews on the press and reviews page under about at joyfulvegan.com. And some of you have reached out and are helping me line up talks. The toughest contacts of which to get to find are for universities. So definitely let me know if you have any contacts for universities. But I've lined up a few more appearances between the last podcast and this one. They're not all up on the website just yet, but in addition to what's there now, like Los Angeles, and of course we've got Oakland, and we've got the Italy trip, and we've got the cruise coming up. I'll be seeing you in Atlanta and in Chicago. So there are lots more coming, and definitely keep reaching out to organizers. It's pretty amazing. Also, a number of you have made donations upon hearing about the amount of money I've had to spend on shipping the book. I mentioned in the last episode that, you know, the budget went over for me. And of course, I invested in this book, just as you invested in this book. And of course, there's also the shipping. I cannot thank you enough for those of you who've just made one-off donations. What wasn't available at the time I was budgeting for the book when we were doing the Indiegogo program. So by the time we finished photographing, editing, designing, and printing the book, what wasn't available was money for shipping from the printer. You have to imagine we're talking about thousands of books, and they have to be sent in, you know, in crates from the printer to the fulfillment house. And then, of course, from there, we've got the fulfillment house to Amazon. And again, we're talking about thousands of books. And then we're talking about the fulfillment house to all of the Indiegogo funders. And then for those that I had to personalize, we're talking about going from the printer to the fulfillment house to me, to then the Indiegogo supporters. So there were just shipping costs and continue to be shipping costs that could not have been calculated at the time of the Indiegogo campaign when it started, because when I budgeted the book for the Indiegogo campaign, I had no idea that the book was going to be 2.3 pounds, right? Each book. So that's the hardcover special. I wanted to make it special for all of the Indiegogo supporters. And we will move to paperback as soon as we're finished selling out this run of the hardcover. But it's expensive to send a 2.5 pound book. Yes, even through Media Mail. Some people have recommended on Facebook that I check out Media Mail. Believe me, we're trying to send it as cost effectively as possible. And that includes internationally. But there were a lot of international supporters, which is incredible. And I'm so grateful to all of you, but the international shipping has also been incredibly expensive. So, you know, it's just been a lot more than I expected. And I'm so grateful to all of you who've made donations to alleviate the burden of these costs. As I said in my recent YouTube video called "From a Thank You From Me to You," because I didn't have the funds to hire a PR team, I've been doing all of the PR and marketing myself. The assistant I recently hired has pretty much been consumed by customer service and the Indiegogo fulfillment. So I've been reaching out to media myself, and I cannot wait until Elizabeth has the bandwidth to be able to help me do this. But it's been so incredible. I've been doing all the outreach to media myself, and it's been really hard, but it's been really gratifying. Every media hit you've seen, like the morning shows that I've done, the TV shows that I've done, the TV segments and the interviews, any articles that have been written, any reviews that have been written, the one that just came out in SF Weekly, it's because I've been working my butt off, finding the right contacts, writing the press release, emailing them, customizing these emails, following up. It is so much work. And I know why PR people make the money they do, but it's been working and it's been really incredible. So watch the thank you video because I explain the difference between independently publishing a book and what it was like when I had publishers. And just go check it out because I think this whole insider aspect of publishing a book, I think might be really interesting to you. So just to recap, I have had a show, an interview on Sacramento. So Sacramento is really interested in my work. Sacramento has responded beautifully. So I was on a CBS morning show in Sacramento, which goes out to, you know, a pretty wide audience. And then of course, it's really great because we can just put the clip on the website, which is on joyfulvegan.com right now. And that was just fantastic. And then I was on a Sacramento Fox station and I've already been invited back. So I'm going back on February 11th and we're going to do an aphrodisiac, you know, vegan food aphrodisiac segment. So Bethany, who's the host there, she and I really just clicked, and I clicked with the other guys too. I'm really hoping to go back to the CBS show as well. But Bethany and I really clicked, and I'm looking forward to going back there. And then tomorrow, actually, I'm recording this on Saturday. I think you're going to get this on Saturday. But Sunday, which is tomorrow for me, I will be in the studios at Oakland Fox Station. So it's just been so incredible. And of course, I had to make sure that I made the time to write today's podcast episode. And so here we are. And as I said in the introduction, in today's episode, we're going to examine rituals that involve animals, either via slaughter or sacrifices, which also entails slaughter, but one tends to be for consumption, one is not necessarily for consumption, but often is. And the role these rituals play in justifying and legitimizing and romanticizing the procurement and consumption of animal products. Whether we're talking about the ritual slaughter of animals for consumption, such as kosher slaughter in Judaism and halal slaughter in Islam, or animal sacrifices where, like I said, the animals are killed without necessarily being consumed, we're going to be talking about all of these. And when it comes to religious rituals, of course, the big question is whether religious freedom is unlimited, even when it contributes to human or animal suffering. Now, as you can imagine, there is so much to talk about here, and I would do it a great injustice if I tried to pack it all into one episode. So this will be the first of many on this topic. I wanted to lay the foundation first about what rituals are and why they're significant in human culture, because they are significant in human culture. I mean, just as humans, we've been doing this for millennia. So one episode we're going to cover is going to be kosher slaughter, and we're going to talk all about that. One episode will be on halal. One will be on just all other kinds of animal sacrifices. And, you know, we'll talk about the methods, because this question comes up a lot around kosher slaughter and halal. We'll talk about the methods so that you can judge for yourself whether or not they're quote-unquote humane in and of themselves, and whether or not they're quote-unquote humane compared to conventional slaughter. We'll also talk about why the majority of food taboos center around meat and other animal products rather than on plants. And we'll also address the use of animal products in various ceremonies, such as cow's milk in some ceremonies in Hinduism, or the use of the ram's horn in Judaism. So you can see we have a lot to cover. But today we're going to talk about ritual in general. So let's start with what ritual is. The dictionary definition is a ceremony in which the actions and wording follow a prescribed form and order. A related definition, a set of actions that are conducted routinely in the same manner, like drinking tea as part of a morning ritual. And now you know one of my rituals. I am incredibly ritualistic. I can say that right now. And I'm sure as you start to examine your own day, you will see how many rituals you take part in any given day. The word ritual comes from the word rite, R-I-T-E, which may come from a Proto-Indo-European word for number or count, highlighting the emphasis that's placed on the prescribed order of the actions or wording, right? So all seems pretty innocuous. Ritual is a pretty broad topic. A ritual is a routine that we participate in because for a number of reasons, right? It makes us feel good, makes us feel connected, it reduces anxiety, etc., as I said earlier. Extensive research indicates that everyday rituals have a real impact on our thoughts, our feelings, and our behaviors. And I don't doubt that. I think we know that anecdotally, but research bears that out. Then there are the rituals we all participate in around food, right? Praying before a meal, eating certain foods during certain holidays, sitting in the same chair around the table, eating at the same time each night, even the order in which we eat the food on our plates. I know I engage in that ritual. I could do a whole episode on all the rituals I engage in. Every culture participates in food rituals in which we perform actions that have no obvious value in and of themselves, right? So, of course, psychologists and anthropologists have been studying for years what it is we get out of these food rituals and ceremonies. And there are some interesting findings. There's some interesting findings about how food rituals can actually enhance our taste of food. Other compelling conclusions point to something that relates to our subsequent discussion of food taboos, specifically about how food rituals increase our sense of community and our closeness to that community. One expert puts it this way, and I think it's really brilliant because I think this gets at the heart of it. One expert says, it's not so much that food is good to eat as it is good to forbid. Catholics, for example, used to find a bond between each other and mark a difference between them and Protestants by substituting fish for meat on Fridays. And there's evidence that the reason pork became a forbidden food in many religions was for the same reason. It served to distinguish one sect from the next. So food rituals bring us together and also serve to separate us from those we want to be distinct from. I think that's really fascinating. So rituals, evident in almost all societies, past and present, can be secular. They can be rites of passage. They can mark the passage of time and link the past and the present. They can be symbolic. They can be loaded with meaning, and they can be absolutely meaningless. They can be irrational or concrete. They can be sacred. They can create healing. They can create harm. They can provide catharsis. They can create discipline. Now, of course, rituals play a role in secular society. And as I said, that happens in our everyday lives. And of course, they also play a huge role in spiritual and religious life. Some are filled with meaning, as I said. Some are symbolic. Some are everything I named above. They can help and they can harm. One element of religious rituals is sacrificial killing of both human and non-human animals. Human sacrifices have been carried out in many, many cultures and many religions throughout the centuries. And although they've virtually disappeared from most societies, the idea behind the sacrifice of a living being was that when killed ritualistically, it would please or appease the gods or God. Most religions now condemn human sacrifice. And though there are still individuals who, of course, you know, justify killing someone as a religious sacrifice, it's not condoned. And it is, of course, murder because killing someone is illegal when that someone is a human being. When you're talking about the ritual slaughter of non-human animals, it's a whole different story. And it's very broad. I said earlier, too broad to cover today. But a distinction I do want to make today is between ritual slaughter and animal sacrifice. Ritual slaughter is the ritual killing of animals for human consumption. Animal sacrifice is the ritual killing of animals, not necessarily for human consumption. They are indeed consumed. Ritual slaughter comes with an entire set of rules for how to slaughter, who can do the slaughtering, the method of slaughter, even the tools, the weapons, one might say, I just said, for slaughter. But animal sacrifices are not necessarily about how the animal is slaughtered, sometimes it is, but that he is slaughtered as a sacrifice to the gods. Now, there was a time, such as in antiquity, when ritual slaughter and animal sacrifice were one and the same, but that's really not the case so much as time went on. And of course, as I said, both have roots in religion. Now, of course, examples of ritual slaughter include killing animals according to Jewish law to ensure that it's kosher, killing animals according to Islamic law so that it's halal. Those are examples of ritual slaughter. Examples of animal sacrifice. Animal sacrifices were so common throughout antiquity, just ridiculously common, unfortunately, in Europe, in the Near East, paganism, ancient Rome, ancient Greece, name it. But those that persist today, you would probably be familiar with. I think you will. And again, we're going to do a podcast specifically on these different types of animal sacrifices that still persist today, like Kaparot, where a rooster is ritually killed on the afternoon before Yom Kippur in Judaism. In Islam, you've got Eid al-Adha, which means feast of the sacrifice, in which an animal, often a lamb or a goat, is sacrificed for this holy day. And you may have heard of the ritual killing of animals in the Santeria religion. Now, the legal aspects of ritual slaughter include the regulation of slaughterhouses and butchers, and religious personnel from these different religions are involved in these regulations. And of course, the issue of ritual slaughter, as well as animal sacrifice, has been contested and discussed in the courts for many, many years. Although you don't see as much about animal sacrifice as you see about animal, you know, ritual slaughter, and we're going to talk about that at great length. Richard Ryder has a perspective on this, on the decline of animal sacrifice. He's the author of Animal Revolution, Changing Attitudes Towards Speciesism, and I highly recommend this book. He has an interesting perspective on the decline of animal sacrifice. He writes, "The decline in non-human sacrifice in Europe and Asia over the last 2,000 years should not be taken to be a sign of growing respect for non-humans, but of a belief that the gods were not to be placated in this way. Paradoxically, animal sacrifice works best, surely, when non-humans are perceived as being kin and thus qualifying as human sacrificial surrogates." Right? I mean, that's so interesting that in a way, lowering the status of animals from deities to below humans means they're not worthy of being sacrificed to the gods. So I think it's a really interesting way to look at it. But of course, you know, ignorance also plays a huge role in the decisions we made and make, and fear also play a huge role. So I just think that's really fascinating. So I do recommend that book. So as I've said, rituals are not necessarily rational, they're not necessarily logical, and it might seem silly to talk about the reasons they're performed, but because they are such a huge part of our human experience, both secularly and religiously, and in ways that harm and ways that help, they're so pervasive that I think, especially when it comes to rituals related to food, that I think it's worth looking at what psychologists and anthropologists suggest are the reasons for or the benefits of food rituals and taboos. Now, I find it interesting, as I said, and we'll talk about this when we get to the taboo episode, but there are the primary targets of food taboos are animal products. There are some taboos around plant foods, but they're mostly around animal products. And we're going to talk about taboos, and we're going to talk about the ethnological investigations into this fact. But what purpose do ritual slaughter and animal sacrifice serve in the past and, of course, in the present? So that's the big question. Like, why are we doing this? What are people getting out of it? And what justifications are being used to continue them? So I'm going to tell you that in just one moment, but I want to take just a minute to thank all of you out there, all of you listeners, and of course, all of the listeners who support this podcast. I just found out that I'm a top creator on Patreon. So Patreon is the service we use now for people to become regular supporters of this podcast, and you get many perks for being a patron, as we call it. I'm in the top 100, which I was really surprised by, because there are some serious creators out there on Patreon making a lot of money, getting a lot of support from their audience. So I was really surprised that I was in the top 100, but I also thought it was really cool. I'm pretty down low on the list, but it's really a testament to you for supporting this podcast. So if you want to keep me in that top 100, and if you want to really, you know, again, support the work that I'm doing here, you need to go over to Patreon, and you can find the link through joyfulvegan.com. There are some recent supporters who got me on that list, and I want to thank Carolyn Steele, Wendy Werneth, Andrew Hamilton, who contributed in the names of Jennifer and Tyler Patterson. We have Michal Stone. And then I realized in the last episode, I didn't thank last month's supporters, Todd Hilson, Melissa Amarelio, Catherine Smiley, Amanda Tarani, who has been hugely generous. I just have to give a quick shout out to Amanda, who is a patron, but she's also been so generous in helping me spread the word. She's sponsoring me to speak in a few cities. She's actually paying for my travel to get to the cities that where the organizations are hosting me to speak. She's actually sponsoring me to do that. So that is an option for some of you who are interested in that. I'm just throwing it out there because Amanda has stepped up to do that for a couple of the talks. But Amanda Tehrani, thank you so much for what you have been doing to support me. Madeline Cote, Victoria Mayer, and Diane Erskine. Gosh, I'm sorry, Diane. Erskine, right? That's how you say it. We have our next Google Hangout with me and Gold supporters coming up. So if you'd like to participate in a regular Hangout with me where you can ask me any questions you like and basically interview me and talk to me and talk to one another and connect with one another, which is really special, you can look at the level for the support level to be able to get that. But whatever level you come in, and it's a huge help and I'm so grateful. And you can also make a one-time donation. So please go to joyfulvegan.com to do so. So returning to our question, what purpose do ritual slaughter and animal sacrifice serve in the human experience in the past, in the present? Why are we justifying this for what reasons are we saying we're doing this? So one answer is rituals shift the blame. Sacrificial customs are elaborate exercises in blame shifting, particularly when they're justified in religion. The individual might, like the priest or the rabbi or, some holy person, might be directly responsible for the animal's death, like doing the killing, but they justify it as a sacred duty, and which is therefore forgivable, right? The gods are blamed instead because they demanded the sacrifice. In Babylon, for instance, ancient Babylon, the priests would whisper in the ears of their sacrificial victims that it was the gods who made them do it. That's the idea of blame shifting. So that's pretty prevalent. Number two, rituals legitimize what is ugly. They legitimize what makes us uncomfortable. Rituals transform something ugly into something legitimate. Ritual killing legitimizes slaughter. Killing is hard. Killing is ugly. It's bloody. It's incredibly emotional. It is not easy. And ritualizing slaughter romanticizes it. Couching it in sacred language softens it. And even though it's not inevitable today, consuming animals, we know we don't have to eat animals to be healthy. By ritualizing it, we justify it and feel better about it. Now, I say similar things about this in many places, including in On Being Vegan in chapter 5, Eating Animals to Save Them. And I think it makes a nice tweetable. So here's today's tweetable. The degree to which we disguise, rationalize, romanticize, and ritualize the consumption of animal flesh and fluids belies our discomfort with it. Now, you can shorten that a little bit. That fits practically as a tweetable, but if you want to make sure you tag me, you can shorten that a little bit. But the degree to which we disguise, rationalize, romanticize, and ritualize the consumption of animal flesh and fluids belies our discomfort with it. In fact, here's the rest of that paragraph related to what I keep saying about ritualizing animal products versus plant foods. This is directly from On Being Vegan, Chapter 5. Although I distinctly remember my parents trying to allay my concerns about any pain the animals may have felt before and while they were being killed, I have no memory of them having to dry my tears over the picking, peeling, and cutting of fruits and vegetables. Never did the boiling of rice bring me to tears. Never did the mashing of potatoes evoke disgust or pity in me. It's true that I had to be enticed to eat certain vegetables, such as broccoli and peas, but there was no need to tell me tales to alleviate any guilt. There was no guilt because there was no living animal. I pulled carrots from our garden and picked tomatoes off their vines with no compunction at all, no denial of reality, no dreams of innocence, no excuses. In context, by the way, I'm alluding to what Michael Pollan says about vegetarians living in a delusional world. He talks about living in, you know, dreams of innocence, that we deny reality. So you can read it for yourself. On Being Vegan is available. It is available on Amazon. It's available through my website for you in print or as an ebook. The third justification, reason for rituals, especially around food, is a belief, especially around animal slaughter, is a belief in transference. A common belief, particularly in ancient as well as in traditional societies, but we see it playing out today in the fetishizing of meat consumption, is the idea that by consuming the sacrificial animal, you assimilate the characteristics of the animal you've killed or consumed. For instance, by killing a large male bull, the human takes on the qualities of the bull, the strength, the courage, etc. Like I said, it's not rational, but it is a rationale, and it's a strongly held belief by those who live by it. This transference is also seen when people kill an animal in place of a human being. Like I said earlier, when I read Richard Rider's quote, justifying it because the deity, the god or the gods, was merciful enough to accept an animal in place of a human. And that's relevant in terms of Richard Rider's quote, because the animal would have been seen as worthy of being a surrogate for that human. And we see this in religions where animal sacrifice is an honor of the ancestors who died. So they're a symbolic replacement for a loved one or for a human being. Also, we see this in the history of animals shifting from deities to victims of animal sacrifice. So returning to the bull as an illustration, the bull, the male bovine, is prominently depicted in Paleolithic cave paintings in Spain, suggesting the worship of a bull deity, which morphed into the sacred bulls of Egypt. Mithra was the name. Mithra was the name of the divine bull deity. But as Mithraism moved into the West, it was transformed into the masculine bull killing myth, which is most likely the origin of modern bullfighting and the apex of the myth of masculinity and domination, ultimately man conquering beast. That's the ultimate symbolism of killing these animals in order to take on their strength, but also to demonstrate our ability to dominate over them, right? So ultimately, to my mind, the ritual aspect of slaughter exists to raise it up, to make it something we can be more comfortable with. This includes in traditional societies. And I talk about this a little bit also in the episode on Native Americans. I think it's called I pray over the animals, you know, I honor the animals I eat, just like the Native Americans did. When we romanticize this idea of, you know, praying over them and coupling it with something higher, right, something spiritual, something larger than our own human experience on this earth, then it's quite literally sanctified. And so we often do that when we want to make something that we're uncomfortable with more palatable. Where it gets tricky is that it's tied up in religion and thus seemingly untouchable, right? Freedom of religion is certainly an important tenet to uphold. But the question we have to ask as a society is, are religious rights, R-I-G-H-T-S, are religious rights as they relate to rights, R-I-T-E-S, unlimited, right? Are religious rights unlimited? And we'll talk about the details of this when we talk about specific instances of bans on ritual slaughter and attempts to ban ritual slaughter. But as Marianne Thieme, who's the head of the Animal Rights Party in the Netherlands, said before the vote on banning slaughter was cast in the Netherlands, for us, religious freedom stops where human or animal sacrifice begins. And we'll take up that question when we talk about kosher slaughter, halal slaughter, etc. But I first felt it was important to lay the foundation for what rituals are, what the difference is between ritual slaughter and animal sacrifice, how ritual killing is justified, and so on. I wanted to lay that foundation so we can refer back to this when we talk about the specific types of ritual slaughter. So until next time, thanks for listening. Please subscribe to the Food for Thought feed, leave a review on iTunes, and start a conversation over at joyfulvegan.com on the page for today's episode. I want your participation in this. I want to hear from you. Please support the podcast and share today's tweetable. The degree to which we ritualize, rationalize, romanticize, and disguise the consumption of animal flesh and fluids belies our discomfort with it. On behalf of the animals, both human and non-human, this is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thanks for listening.